Good. Just as I'm choking on a sip of water, that's what I'm doing.
They wait for that moment.
I know, right?
They can
see
it.
Me. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I'm here with Kimberly Adams. Make Me Smart on a Tuesday today. The Deep Dive Show, a biggie today. This is going to be a good conversation, right?
Yeah, today's topic is the economic cost of racism in the United States. Obviously, this year with the pandemic and the police killing of George Floyd, it just put a major spotlight on America's long history of racism and inequality across so many spheres. Healthcare, obviously, in the pandemic, but also in the economy more broadly. And that inequality, it comes with a big price tag.
It is a huge price tag, $16 trillion. That's according to Dana Peterson. She is a chief economist at the Conference Board, and she did a study a little bit ago that came up with that number. So we're going to talk about that and some of the ancillary things that kind of go along with it, because it's tough to wrap up all of racism in this economy in one number. Dana Peterson, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you first if you agree with the premise that we can put a price tag on it, but really that only kind of scratches the surface.
Indeed, it only accounts for a few aspects of racial gaps, namely housing, employment, education, and then also access to credit for businesses. We didn't even delve into what the wealth gap would look like, and that would be even more enormous.
One of the things that really struck me about your paper is that this is just, that $16 trillion just covers the last 20 years. I wonder what it would have looked like. I mean, can you even conceptualize it any further back than that? What does it mean that it's that much money in that condensed amount of time?
Well, certainly if we extrapolate this back to several hundred years, the economic cost would be just enormous. But when we looked at the data, much of the data that we had broken down by race extended back about two decades. And so we figured that was a good place to start. And also, it's still the modern era. You know, 2000 really wasn't that long ago, yet we can see how racial gaps have widened and had a negative influence on the economy as well as the people who are suffering under these gaps.
You're the trained economist. I am a guy who speaks his native tongue into a microphone for a living, so I'm going to need you to walk me through this in a really layperson-y kind of way. When you sat down to do this, what was your methodology? How did you attack this problem?
Sure. We looked at a number of things and we said, well, what would happen if we equalized wages? Or what would happen if the same number of people, who asked for credit to obtain a mortgage actually received that mortgage, and how much would they have spent on things like furniture and cars and all the accoutrements that go along with housing? And then once we added that up over 20 years, we were able to come up with this gigantic number of $16 trillion.
And so, you know, after you ran all those numbers, did all those calculations, what actually jumped out to you the most?
I think what was the most startling was the $3 trillion less in business revenues, just from the fact that many Black-owned businesses are either afraid to apply for credit or are applying for credit and are not getting the amount of money that they've requested. And so that means that these businesses, if they're not even started, and some even start but end up folding, are losing out on tons of revenue. And as a consequence, roughly 6 million people per year are not hired by these Black-owned firms simply because of lack of access to credit.
Wait a second. That's 6 million jobs a year that this economy is not getting because of the racism fundamentally?
Yes. And that's basically because when we look at even the Federal Reserve has looked at this information here, and they did a study and they found out that most of the time businesses close because of lack of access to capital. That means either they don't have access to capital markets or through lending loans from traditional banking institutions. And again, when you look at Black-owned businesses, many of them actually do have saved a lot of money. But they still have a lot of difficulty going to traditional banks in terms of getting those loans. Either they're denied or the amount of money that they received is less than what was expected. And so that usually means that they don't have enough capital to keep running. And so certainly if you're not operating, then that means people become unemployed, or you just never hire those people in the first place. And so it is a huge loss, not only in terms of revenue, but also with respect to labor markets.
You worked on this report in your previous job at Citi, and you also have said in other interviews that this report and working on it kind of helped you tell your own story. How did it do that?
Sure. So the genesis of this report was Citi researchers. I was on the diversity committee at Citi within the Citi research department, and we were trying to understand how we should respond in a way that would be impactful. And so we came up with a number of activities, but one that I recommended was actually writing a paper looking at these gaps and then interpreting them in terms of dollars and cents as opposed to just a moral imperative. And indeed, it's a moral imperative. But when you're on Wall Street, breaking down things into numbers and relating it to something in terms of lost revenue or job losses or even GDP losses made the best sense. And we figured that that was a good way to explain these gaps in the language that our clients and our colleagues would understand and would relate to.
So we are one of many outfits, I'm sure, that have called you to talk about this. What has the response been?
So far, the response has been really great. Most people have said, wow, I had no idea that this was even a problem. Or they said, gee, I knew there was something wrong, but I never could think about how to quantify it. And so I think it's been very helpful in terms of bringing a conversation to so many different people. And I think it also brings a historicity to the conversation where people understand that these problems didn't just crop up post-pandemic or in the last 20 years. These have been issues since, going back 100 years, decisions that were made by governments within the U.S. and corporations and private citizens led to many of these gaps that are persisting and widening today.
Hmm. It kind of reminds me of this experience that I've had, throughout my career that, A, you have to demonstrate that racism exists, and B, that you have to demonstrate that it is bad and damaging to people who might not otherwise believe you. And, I wonder from a personal perspective what it was like sort of going through this process for you, being one of the few Black women in your industry, having to lay this out in this way.
Well, I think I actually received a lot of support. And I think because people were focused on race in America over the summer, given the protests that erupted in response to repeated instances of negative interactions between Black people and police, the coronavirus pandemic, which seemed to be disproportionately harming people of color. And so people were very sensitized to this sort of thing, and they were very supportive.
But let me take that a step further, right? Because people were supportive and sensitized, but here we are at a moment, look, I asked this question a lot this past summer, and it doesn't seem much has changed, right? This past summer, right after George Floyd, I was asking a lot of people on Marketplace whether they thought this was a moment that would change things, and so far it hasn't really. And granted, this is a decades-long solution that you're talking about being necessary. But do you think this moment catalyzes anything?
Well, I think we have seen some movement. Certainly, things that are easy. So, for example, changing a flag, right, or renaming something. I mean, those are things that many people can get behind because it's an easy fix. You can do that overnight. But when it comes to addressing long-term potentially structural inequalities, that's difficult because it requires people to A, recognize that there's a problem, B, have a desire to fix it, and then C, actually do the work to fix those things. And certainly I've seen a number of banks, the financial sector has really stepped up to the plate. Indeed, a number of banks, including Citi, have committed billions of dollars to addressing racial gaps, things in terms of making sure that lending is fair, that they are providing dollars for communities, Black communities. And so there has been some movement. I mean, again, some things are going to be very difficult to change, but it's certainly the recognition is there and the dollars are being committed.
That's on the corporate side, and particularly in the financial sector. What about governments and other actors in this economy? What else needs to happen to, I guess you can't bring back that $16 trillion, but to close that moving forward?
Right. And that's the tough thing, where you need institutions and governments to think about, well, what are our policies doing to encourage the perpetuation of these gaps? So thinking about housing and housing segregation, do zoning laws encourage people of different colors to live in certain areas? Is there still redlining going on? Even when you think about technology, for example, there was one technology platform that was effectively redlining people and discouraging people from looking in certain areas because of racial makeups. So it's kind of prolific quite widespread. And so you need to attack this on multiple fronts, governments, individuals, corporations, both financial and non-financial corporations, looking at their policies and understanding how they are affecting individual groups of people. And indeed, when we look at the Federal Reserve, since I brought up the Fed earlier, several central bankers have focused more on looking at indicators produced by government agencies that look at different racial groups. So, for example, with COVID, many more people of color suffered higher unemployment rates relative to people who were not necessarily of color, right? So these types of things are certainly areas that every organization, every branch of government, every individual needs to look at and explore.
I don't want to get all wonky here, but Kimberly and I have both done panel discussions with three Federal Reserve banks, Boston, Minneapolis, and Atlanta, and they are working on a series of programs and presentations about diversity and racial equity in terms of what the Fed can do. And I wonder, and again, not to get too wonky, but do you think the Fed's dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment ought to be changed to reflect some of the realities that have now become apparent to mainstream economists?
Well, I think the dual mandate does encompass the different demographic groups. If you think about maximum employment, you can think of it in a macro sense where you look at the civilian unemployment rate that gets published every first Friday of the month, right? Where it just mm-hmm. looks overall. But you could also think about, well, what's maximum employment for different groups, for women, for young people, for Black people, for Latin people, and think about whether or not you're achieving those goals. And certainly the Fed's new mandate of inflation, average mm-hmm. inflation mm-hmm. targeting, means that they are going to be much more patient about inflation before they raise interest rates, which means that gives more time for unemployment rates, especially unemployment rates for different demographic groups, to continue to fall.
We have this number, $16 trillion, that it's cost the economy broadly, but also, as you lay out in your paper, it has cost people of color, and particularly Black people. What about reparations as a response to try to rectify some of those losses?
Well, that's certainly a hot button issue, because many people say, well, you're asking me to pay for the sins of, my ancestors, right? So I wasn't a slave owner. I didn't oppress people. I wasn't the one who didn't give Black people their 40 acres and a mule. So why should I now be forced to pay for it?
But you're talking about just the last 20 years.
Right. I mean, another argument is, well, you do have systemic racism, and it's meaning that even if the laws have changed and even if people's sentiments have changed, the repercussions are still there. The repercussions of decisions that were made a long time ago and biases from, the past are still with us today. And so we should address those repercussions. And it makes sense to spend federal or state and local dollars to address those factors that are still causing these racial gaps. And instead of, reparations, which implies giving, a certain amount of money to individuals, you can invest in communities that have, a broad impact that benefits everyone. You can invest in early childhood education. You can invest in training for adults. You can also write laws that make sure that there's no discrimination in hiring. Companies can also think about when they're hiring and firing that they have, you know, diverse slate in terms of who they're bringing in. And also when they're letting people go, that they're making sure they're not that certain populations aren't overrepresented in those losses. So certainly there are different ways to talk about making amends. And a lot of that is in investment in closing these racial gaps.
Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board, thank you for all of that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was a lot.
It's a lot.
That's a lot. You know, I know I said this to her, but I'm just still stuck that it was that much money in just 20 years.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even factor in the emotional toll or mental health toll or, you know, what it does to our social, our society to have this flowing through our economy and our lives.
Yeah. And every now and then it breaks through to the surface. And look, this is a cynical thing to say. It breaks through to the surface and everybody goes, oh my God, we have to pay more attention to this and fix it. And then something else happens and it, you know, gets subsumed. And I just, it's really hard to
keep.
Yeah, but
everybody is pretty specific.
Yeah.
You know, it's people who had been able to turn away because it wasn't affecting them on a day-to-day basis, shift their focus.
Right.
And then, you know, the concern that you and I have talked about a lot is this concern that once the moment passes, the gaze shifts away again and the people who are at the other side of these, you know, inequal or unfair economic conditions are still left to deal with those consequences.
Yep. For sure. All right. Anyway, if you have a question or a comment that I'm sure you do about this conversation we had with Dana Peterson, or honestly, anything else, you know we're game for anything. You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll do what we always do, take a quick break, and come on right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right. Welcome back. Time for the news fix.
Okay. So I'm just going to climb in here real quick. A couple of weeks ago, right after the election, and Prop 22 in California passed, which is the ballot initiative out here that Uber and Lyft spent $200 million on so that they could continue to qualify categorize their drivers as contractors and not as employees. And Molly and I had a conversation about it. And I said, what do you think? Is this going to spread to other states? And she said, oh, yeah, for sure. And lo and behold, in the Washington Post today, this headline, Uber wants to expand Prop 22 to other states. So I'm just saying that push by the gig economy driving platform companies is not just here in California. It's going to happen all over the place. And it's a sign of and a symptom of the changing workforce in this country. And it's kind of bizarre.
You know, since you mentioned those Fed panels that you and I have been working on, the one that I was on racism and employment. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, occupational segregation and how people of color and women tend to be segregated into these types of jobs that don't have full access to benefits. And, you know, the gig economy and the Ubers and the Lyfts, the in some ways, the research that talks about this says, you know, that there are actual laws written, like, for example, that, you know, domestic workers for so long are left out of a lot of the traditional employment protections because that mainly affected women and often women of color, that laws are actually written that sort of shoehorn disadvantaged groups into these low wage jobs without protections. And here we have a law that is just being passed and perpetuated that, you know, is disproportionately affecting these lower wage workers who aren't getting benefits that are going to be disproportionately people of color. And it kind of is all like coming together with what, you know, Dana just told us.
For sure. Totally for sure. Some things change, some things don't.
You know. Well, but we don't, you know, these are things that we as voters and citizens decide whether or not we will accept and or tolerate.
It's true.
And if the last couple of months have taught us anything, it's that people can step up to force a political change sometimes against pretty stiff odds.
It's
So yours is sort of looking forward at legislation coming down. Mine is looking back at policies. It's another piece from the Washington Post about one of the many, many programs that were included in the CARES Act that kind of just flew out the door to try – well, even before the CARES Act, in the government's rush to initially respond to the pandemic. And we talked about it a little bit on Marketplace, this food box program. For the poor that was designed to help these farmers that suddenly had all this excess supply that they couldn't, you know, ship elsewhere or the supply chains were broken down, and to get that food into boxes to the most, you know, needy of these resources, food banks and all these other people. So now House Democrats are alleging that basically there was a lot of corruption in this program. That the pandemic relief operation, this is just from the start of the story, that it redirected $3 million to one of the largest awardees in a key Trump pandemic relief operation, redirected $3 million to its own nonprofit organization, despite its lack of track record or capacity in delivering food to people in need. And this is allegations by House Democrats. And I'm thinking about these lines of people all across the country right now trying to get access to food. And, you know, on the one hand, these programs went out the door so quickly because it was an emergency. It's kind of inevitable that there would be someone trying to game the system. But I wonder how much capacity there is because we're still in an emergency to actually track this stuff. Yeah. And I know that there's been some people trying to go back and look at who got those PPP dollars. But there's a lot to look into here. And programs that that are this big, that go out this quickly, and especially with relatively limited oversight, given sort of the shrinking of the bureaucracy under the Trump administration, I worry about, you know, how effectively some of those dollars were used.
No, that's totally a great point. And you have to figure the fraud quotient there is not small. Right? Just proportionally speaking. All right. Let's do a little mail.
All right.
Hello, Molly and Kai. Hello.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Okay, so first up is a tweet that I received about our half full, half empty segment last Friday, which is the new game for Make Me Smart. I said I was feeling half full about Amazon Pharmacy, mainly because I thought that, you know, for all of Amazon's problems, at least they're good at logistics and it might help access to prescription medications, hopefully lower cost, particularly in rural areas. So I got this series of tweets from Dr. Tyler Frederick. He's a pharmacist, and he wrote this. You should definitely be half empty about Amazon's pill pack, which is one of Amazon's pharmacy programs. Even though you are right and that Amazon could be great about getting medicine to patients, it's big box stores like Amazon, CVS, Walgreens, and the like that are putting independent pharmacies out of business. Not only do these pharmacies provide medications to patients, often with delivery, but can provide other testing, counseling, medical equipment, and so much more. Also, it keeps money local in these often rural and poor parts of the country instead of shipping it to another state. I don't mean to be harsh. You're not. It's fine. But as a pharmacist who works for a local pharmacy in rural Kentucky, Amazon's pill pack and similar services from mail order pharmacies are putting small businesses like the one I work for out of business. Thank you, Dr. Frederick. That was really useful context. I should say, on the other hand, we did get an email from a retired family doctor in Arizona who said she's been using Amazon Pharmacy for about a year, and she says it's efficient and affordable. But, you know, all of these things have consequences that play out differently depending on, you know, where you are. And I really appreciate that thought.
Totally. Great thought. And it's the classic Amazon conundrum, right? And people have been pointing this out since Jeff Bezos, you know, sold his first book practically. Mm-hmm. And it's, but a great point from both those writers. Next up, Jeff in Detroit.
I heard you say on the show that only 51% of Americans would take the COVID-19 vaccine when it's offered, and that number is lower for people of color. Well, I just wanted to let you know that I've already taken it since I was in the Moderna trial here in Detroit. By my math, I've got a 47% chance of being immune since it was 50% placebo and 50% vaccine in the population, and the vaccine is 95% effective. When I tell people I took it, they often ask me why. I tell them that as a black man, I want to be able to tell people that this is safe and they should take it so that we can get past this pandemic. Keep doing what you're doing and making us all smarter.
Amen. And thank you for taking part in that trial. I mean, that takes guts, right? Takes some guts, truly.
It does. It does. And I think this is the work that is ahead for public officials, people in the pharmaceutical industry, to convince people to take it, you know, because there's a lot of mistrust floating around in the public right now. Those numbers about people who would take the vaccine seem to have been ticking up a bit in recent weeks. But there is a huge campaign trying to convince people this is safe. Okay, this next voice memo comes from Brian in Reno.
Thanksgiving's approaching, and I just wanted to reach out and tell you how thankful I am to you and your crew to making us smart and sane every single day. My dad passed away earlier this year from COVID. He was one of the unlucky few to be on the cruise ship that was held off of San Francisco Bay. And when he went into the hospital, I think there were 180 deaths nationwide, which is crazy to think how far we've come since then. But the week that he went into the hospital was the same week that you guys started doing your daily show. And it was a, you know, 10 to 20 minutes of solace every single day as I worked outside in my victory garden. And since then, I haven't missed a day ever since. So thank you for keeping us all informed. Staying informed makes us able to make smart decisions that may save a life down the line. And we can all be heroes every day. And just want to say happy Thanksgiving, and I appreciate you all. Thanks.
Oh, man. I mean, thank you. And I'm so very sorry for your loss. Wow. Right? What do you do with that?
Yeah, I'm thankful for you, Brian, for listening and for sharing that. And, you know, he said it's crazy to think how far we've come since then, but in many ways it's also, you know, just ridiculous to think about what we haven't done since then. But I'm thankful that we are making progress.
Yeah.
And thankful to the scientists who have come up with these vaccines. Super thankful for all the healthcare workers who are just really dealing with it right now. So, Yeah. All right. I am going to switch gears here to something that not only made me smile, but it made me squeal when I saw it in the script today.
We should explain. This is the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? It comes to us, this answer does, from Tammy Stronach. She is the actress who played the childlike empress in that movie I have not yet watched, Kimberly Adams, The Neverending Story. Here we go.
Something that I thought I knew and later found out I was wrong about is related to being optimistic. It's kind of embarrassing, but I think as a young person, I thought that if you were overly optimistic, you must be just incredibly naive. You must not be interested in what's really happening in the world. And it turned out that I was wrong. And I learned that through watching my father. My father was an incredibly optimistic man. And as he aged, he died last year. He had Parkinson's, he had heart disease, and about a year ago, he fell and broke his hip. And I watched him struggle with all of these things. And rather than get bitter, he still found a way of really enjoying every day, of making jokes, a little twinkle in his eye. And I realized that he wasn't in any way avoiding reality or unable to see the events that were happening around him. He just had this ability to, despite the difficulties, still find a lot to celebrate.
I like that.
Wow, what a powerful message for us right now. You know, making the choice to highlight and focus on the things for which we can be thankful or celebrate.
Right. And it's counterintuitive, right? Because, look, it's a little less with the vaccine and the election behind us and all of that. Things are a little less dire, but still, it's easy to go not optimistic, I guess is what I'm saying. And you can choose to be the other way, which is good.
I'm kind of still fangirling a little bit here, but also, you know, if the Make Me Smart question is, you know, what's something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about, I should point out to you, because you won't know this because you haven't watched the movie.
Yes, I know.
There's this vigorous debate over what this character's actual name is in the movie. I won't give away the end, like, this is something that people often think they know, but later find out that they're wrong about the name of the childlike empress in Neverending Story. So maybe that will give you the incentive to finally watch
Noted.
All right, please send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. We are at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And I know we sound like a broken record, which are these vinyl discs for those of you who maybe don't remember. Kidding. But please keep the voice memos coming.
I am back tomorrow with Mariel for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Still time, of course, to get your questions in. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Also, just a quick reminder, we're not working Thursday or Friday this week because.
Yeah, and I hope everybody takes some time for themselves. Yeah. Oh, and if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter yet, please check it out. This week, Erica Phillips is going to make us smart about wine from big box stores, which many of us already know about intimately. Apparently, Target's wine is actually pretty good, according to the experts.
I know I'm being snooty here, but wow. I had idea. I had no idea. Truly.
They're really good box wines, Kai.
Okay. Okay.
All right, you can sign up at marketplace.org/newsletter. So you have to watch Neverending Story while drinking
and
box
drink
box
wine. Yes,
that's the only way that it'll work. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ethan Peretz is our intern. And as I mentioned, Erica Phillips writes the newsletter and the smart speaker skill.
Garrett Lang engineered today. Ben Tolliday is going to mix it later on. Senior producer is Donna Tam. Sitar Nieves, executive directs On Demand around here. I still don't know what that is.
I actually love the visual of Kai Rizdahl with box wine.
Oh, man.
Trying to figure out what the name is of the childlike empress.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.